Hi, this is Bruno Senna.
Hi, I'm Mark Webber, and this is Keeping Track.
You're listening to Keeping Track, the official podcast of the Australian Grand Prix.
In this week's episode, we look back at the key moments of 2011 in our F1 season review. Journalist Freddie Petersens explains the impact of Sebastian Vettel's success in his native Germany. Paul Hembree reflects on Pirelli's return to Formula One. And we look ahead to 2012 and the season-opening Australian Grand Prix at Albert Park. There's all that and more on Keeping Track, the official podcast of the Australian Grand Prix.
Hello and a warm welcome to this year's final episode of Keeping Track, the official podcast of the Australian Grand Prix. I'm Stuart Sykes, and this week my co-host Matt Clayton and I will be taking a quick look back at the season that was and the way it all finished up in Brazil. It's a busy show with a couple of key players giving us some enjoyable insights into the contemporary F1 scene, and of course a quick look ahead to our next race, that's the Australian Grand Prix in March. Brazil was the 19th and final race of a long year for the F1 fraternity. It's been dominated, of course, by a young bloke called Vettel, but there have been plenty of other talking points. Matt Clayton, what did you make of Interlagos and of the 62nd season in F1 history?
What I made of Interlagos, Stuart, is I've discovered that I enjoy listening to the Australian National Anthem at 10 to 5 on a Monday morning. It's always nice to listen to the Australian National Anthem at any time, but to listen to it for a Mark Webber win after the difficult season that he's had and to see him in such top form in the last race of the year was just a great way to finish the season, I think.
What did you make of his rather restrained behaviour when he got out of the car? I mean, to use Mark's own expression, there was a smile back on the dial, but he wasn't as exuberant as we might have expected.
Well, I mean, I think he knows the circumstances under which he was able to win the race. He didn't get to have the fight with Sebastian that he wanted to, obviously because Vettel had his gearbox gremlins with second and third gear from probably about 15 laps in. So it wasn't one of those races where he'd gone toe-to-toe with him and actually beaten him. He did have very, very good pace, and he was in the top three across the entire weekend in every session. So we never got to see what could have been quite a good fight. I think he also knew, I think you've got to try and be humble in a situation like that. You don't really want to rub it in. He knew that his teammate was somewhat compromised, but by the same token, the record books don't say how, they just say how many, and I think he'll be very, very pleased to take that seventh career win.
Absolutely, and it has to be said that Sebastian Vettel was extremely gracious in relative defeat. He did finish second despite those gearbox gremlins, and Vettel came off a Saturday on which he created Formula One history.
Extraordinary 15th pole in the season, beating Nigel Mansell's record of 14 from 1992. Should be noted, of course, that Mansell's record came in 16 races, whereas Vettel's was in a 19-race season, and Seb was quick to say that himself. But his ability, Stuart, to just find that extra 2 or 3 tenths on that second lap in Q3 on a Saturday, he's taken the poles he should have this year, but he's also picked up a couple that he shouldn't have. I think Abu Dhabi was one that was just extraordinary. I'm not quite sure where that came from. He just seems to have that in his back pocket. And, other than Ayrton Senna in the last 25 years, it's hard to think of someone who has the ability to flick the switch like he does.
Exactly right. You mentioned Williams there, Nigel Mansell, back in 92. Should we go to the back end of the grid for a moment and just ask ourselves what on earth has happened at Williams in those intervening years and why it is that they can't win a race? The last time they won was in Brazil way back in 2004, and what they're going to do to correct this?
Well, it's funny to think we used to speak of them as being one of the big three, didn't we, with McLaren and Ferrari, and just 5 points for the season, which is absolutely disastrous. It looks like Rubens Barrichello is not going to be back there, and he was one of the great assets. Quite who drives the second Williams alongside Pastor Maldonado next year remains to be seen, but there just doesn't seem to be any great direction there with that team at the moment, which is very sad. They're a very, very popular team. They've got a great history. You can only hope that the move back to Renault engines next year at least revives some good memories of the glory days and they start climbing up the grid, but they've got a very, very long way to go at the moment.
Yeah, 5 points to 650 for Red Bull. It's just quite astonishing, that gap. We know that it's skewed by the quantity of points available these days, but still. Further down the field from Vettel and Webber on the front row, you had a little stoush between Senna and Schumacher. Did you think that Bruno deserved the drive-through penalty?
I thought it was a racing incident, if anything. I thought he was very, very hard done by it. Just two guys fighting for a corner. Okay, perhaps, a little bit race rusty for Senna. He's been out of it for a little while, but I certainly didn't think it was worth a penalty for either of them. Very, very difficult. Alex Wurz was the guest steward. helping the FIA for that race. I'm not quite sure how they adjudicated to give Senna a penalty. I think both drivers were reasonably surprised by that. It was probably just a racing incident. Neither driver managed to recover from that incident in the race, so their races were both more or less over anyway, but just a little unnecessary, I thought, with the penalty.
Absolutely. Also unnecessary but great fun was the couple of donuts done by Felipe Massa at the end of yet another fairly pointless race for him. What do you make of his record this year? He has set, has he not, a most unwelcome record?
Well, he's the first Ferrari driver, I think, Stuart, since 1992 to have not finished on the podium in a season. That's a record that he's certainly not going to want on his CV. The donuts might have been the most highlight thing he'd done for the entire year, really. He really just has not been on the pace. And, you know, I think the car obviously hasn't been great, but to be outscored by Fernando Alonso to the extent that he was, 257 points for Alonso, 118 for Massa. Alonso 10 times on the podium, his teammate 0. So a pretty damning indictment of Felipe's season, really.
And because you wouldn't forgive us if we didn't ask you, who was that last driver? And if you didn't say Ivan Capelli back in 1992, go to the back of the classroom. Kamui Kobayashi down in ninth, but still scoring the 2 points that made absolutely certain that his Sauber team would finish ahead of Toro Rosso.
That was a nice little fight towards the back end of the season. Sauber were very strong in the early part of the season and pretty much stopped to a crawl, and Toro Rosso really, really came on towards the back end of the year, particularly on the high-speed tracks. They were quickest through the speed traps at just about every single Grand Prix. But good rearguard action there by Kobayashi. Didn't qualify very well at Interlagos. He was just 16th on the grid. So to fight through, finish ninth, secure that 7th place in the championship, it's a good reward for the team.
And of course, what I should have said before, that was that 6th went to the excellent Sahara Force India, who finished like a train, and Sutil finished 6th and Di Resta 8th to match that team's best result of the season.
Sutil's another guy who's going to come out of this season with his reputation really, really well enhanced, and it looks like he's probably in line now. It seems that the Raikkonen to Williams move, it may have cooled a little bit. Sutil's a guy who I think could probably fit in there quite well. He's experienced now. He's been around the block. He also comes with a bit of sponsorship, which, as we know, Williams don't mind. But he'd be a better bet, you would think, if they're trying to climb back up the grid. It seems like he is on the outer there at Force India. It looks very much like it's going to be a Di Resta and Hülkenberg lineup there for 2012.
Absolutely. Which means, again, that Germany will have tremendous representation next year. We are in what you might call the German era, and it's certainly a Vettel-dominated era if we take 2010 and particularly 2011 as the benchmarks.
Well, extraordinary season. You just look at the raw numbers from Sebastian this year. His worst race finish, he finished 18 of the 19 races. The worst race finish, funnily enough, was in Germany. He hasn't really managed to crack Germany, has he? He was fourth there on the podium in every other race that he finished. And what he did after the mid-season break, I think it was eight of the last nine races he was on pole, and just absolutely dominant. And I think India, Stuart, was one for me where everyone goes to a circuit where everyone's effectively starting with a blank sheet of paper, and he was just absolutely mesmerising there. And that, and well, frankly, plenty of other drives on Saturdays really summed up his dominance this year.
Absolutely. One area in which he was eclipsed by his teammate, however, was in fastest laps, because Mark set 7, including Brazil, where, despite team orders, he fired in lap after quick lap in the very closing stages of the race. He had 7, Vettel and Hamilton, and Button 3 each, Massa 2 and Alonso 1. So he's quick.
He certainly is. And it's interesting, Stuart, talking about raw statistics. You look at Mark Webber, obviously winning the race in Brazil, jumped up to 3rd in the championship, just pipping Fernando Alonso. It's the same position he finished the 2010 championship in. Obviously had 7 fastest laps, had 3 the previous year. But you compare the two seasons, the fact that he was in the championship fight right the way to the end. I think he led the championship in 2010 after more rounds than any other driver. This year, right from the start in Melbourne, it never really looked likely. So, you know, it just shows you that statistics can lie sometimes, can't they?
Yes, indeed. And to finish on a positive note for Mark, I think it's very nice to note that he has finished first for the first time twice at the same track. And to win twice on a track means that you've made a little niche for yourself. You're not a one-night wonder or a one-hit wonder. And I think it'll do him the world of good as we kick into 2012.
Don't forget to like the Australian Grand Prix on Facebook for behind-the-scenes news, updates and exclusive opportunities.
This is Keeping Track, the official podcast of the Australian GP.
I'm at Yas Marina Circuit. I'm with a Swedish aristocrat who masquerades as a journalist. We call him Freddy Petersens, who actually lives in Germany. So he's well qualified to talk about German drivers and what we will call the Vettel phenomenon. First of all, Freddy, thank you. And why is it that you are resident and have been so resident in Germany without getting kicked out?
Because I'm so such a nice guy. Simple as that. I'm so charming that, you know, nobody can say anything bad about me. That's why I'm still there.
But how come that you work out of Germany? Just because it's convenient for your travel? Or?
Yes, I would say, yeah. I save a lot of time instead of going back to Sweden every time, yes. Saving time and money.
Absolutely. Now, we know you've had one wonderful driver in the shape of Ronnie Peterson. The Germans have had a few over the years. If you don't go back too far, there's Rolf Stommelen, Jochen Maas. Then a man called Michael came along and kind of changed the landscape in Germany. Is that fair to say, especially for the German media, that it was Michael who put Germany on the map?
Oh, definitely. But when you talk about Swedish drivers, you forgot Gunnar Nilsson.
Yeah, well, I wasn't forgetting him.
But you're absolutely right. We said before Michael arrived, when you went to the German Grand Prix, either Hockenheim or Nürburgring, 20,000, 25,000 in the grandstands. Then Michael came, and, you know, within 2 years, it was a sellout. Mm. And especially when he started to win, and then it was Schumacher mania for the rest of the, until, you know, he stopped.
He stopped in 2006. His absence left a bit of a vacuum despite the other German drivers, Nico and Nick and so on. And then along came a chap called Vettel.
True, but when I talked to the RTL people, the German TV people, they said that the shock wasn't that bad as they thought it would be, because they thought, you know, I wouldn't say zero viewers, but it was much better than they thought it would be, so a positive surprise. Then, as you said, Sebastian came, and then we start all over again.
Now, how do you see the Vettel phenomenon, and how has it affected the media in Germany, and I suppose particularly in this day and age, TV?
It has drawn a new generation of Formula One. The Michael Schumacher fans, who were the, you know, 16, 17, 18, the teenagers when he started, they are now middle-aged like he is. So they are now sitting at home watching it. The Schumacher army, as we call them, who follow him more or less all over the world, especially obviously in Europe where they could camp, but you could always see them every circuit around the world. They are now sitting at home watching it on TV, having a cup of tea. Now you have, with Vettel, now you have the teenies back again. And I would say, I mean, this is just my personal impression, that he is more of a girl's man than Schumacher ever was, because Schumacher is sort of nothing negative, but can I say typical German, so a bit of square, and Vettel is like, you know, he's got something in his eye there that is, in Germany call it a Lausbube, someone who, you can't put him in the corner, he's gone. And he always liked practical jokes. And just, you know, the way he's christening his cars. Yes. You know, Kanky Kylie and all that.
Lucky it's Liz.
Yes. And when, for example, he got home to his little village after he won the title last year, he started to talk to everybody on the stage in the local dialect. I mean, only a thing like that really makes him popular. And what I would say would kill Schumacher now is that in a big interview, he says, I'm Swiss, I'm not German. Mm. They don't like that.
Well, that wouldn't have gone down well. And no. Talking about being in another country, Seb, although very German, is also very English in his way, and he works in a British-based team. That must help things go down very well with his mechanics and everything, that relationship, plus the sense of humour.
Absolutely. He likes Fawlty Towers. He loves the Beatles. So, yes, it's... I don't know. Born in the wrong country? I don't know. But you're absolutely right, because you see, when you walk into the team, either in the hospitality unit or in the garage, you see that he's extremely popular. He is making jokes. He's talking to everybody. There's always a laugh around. There's always... Everything is so positive when you're coming in there. A lot of other teams, you walk in straight faces or whatever. Here, you have one big laugh, but they're very hard workers. And that's a phenomenon that everybody is backing and liking Seb so much that if they have to work long, nobody complains.
Yeah.
Because he's so popular and he gives something back.
Yes. Do you think he will have the sort of dedication that Michael had and go on and accumulate title after title? He loves to collect fastest laps and poles and victories and things. Will he be around for a long time?
I think as long as he enjoys it, he will. And I think he will be around for a long time. I don't know if he will have the fastest lap any longer, because they are a little bit angry in the team. Because he always wants to... On the second last lap or the last lap, he wants the fastest one. And the team, for example, in Korea, they call him idiot. They don't like it. Why he does it is that he saw Senna in Monaco told to slow down because he was leading with a country mile. He did slow down and he crashed. And from that incident, Seb says he learned a lesson. You cannot slow down because you lose concentration. And that's why I'm going full speed or every lap until I see the checkered flag. Okay, he takes a risk. He might go off, the engine might blow, whatever. That's why the team calls him an idiot. For him, I have to do it because I don't want to risk to lose concentration and then crash or whatever.
Because if you're in the zone, you're in the zone. You want to stay there.
Exactly.
Now, Freddie, you mentioned Ronnie and Gunnar, who alas is also lost to us. We in Australia, like you in Sweden and me in Scotland, know how important it is to have a driver of your own nationality in your own country to stimulate the interest there. We have Mark, and it just so happens that Mark, of course, is Seb's teammate. How is Mark perceived outside Australia, and particularly in a country like Germany, which has, you know, the Michael factor and now has Seb?
In Germany, I would say mixed reviews. England, popular. I like him a lot because he is, I would say, a typical Australian who says what he thinks and not politically correct, and that's what I really respect him for. He was one of the few drivers, no, he was the only driver who said we shouldn't go to Bahrain because of what happened. Everybody else said, ooh, da-di-di-da-da-da-da, but he was straight talking, and that's what I really enjoy, you know, when you're talking to him. In Germany, as I said, a bit of a mixed review, because they see him as a threat to Seb. But in England, popular, rest of Europe, I don't know. They see him as perhaps just as another driver.
You say a threat to Seb. He hasn't been, alas, for Mark and for us this year. Do you think he can bounce back and do something next year?
I'm not quite sure, because the difficulty he has, he is not a bad driver, no question about it. But what happened at the end of 2010, when Adrian Newey started to build the car, is tailor-made for Sebastian. Everything that Seb wanted is in that car. I don't think that Mark's wishes were fulfilled, which means that Mark's car is a copy of Seb's car. Then it's up to the individual driver to do the setups and so on and so forth. Seb knows exactly which way to go. Mark has been struggling, but give him an equal car. Okay, Seb might beat him, but not with a very huge margin. That I don't think.
Okay, just to go back to our topic, which is German drivers and the Vettel phenomenon, is he the new Michael, or is he simply unique and just the first and only Seb?
The last version. He doesn't want to be compared to anybody else. He said, I'm Sebastian, and that's how it's going to be. The best way for me to describe Sebastian Vettel is, I don't know if you know a Swedish author, she wrote children's books, Astrid Lindgren. Mm. There was one called Emil, and very nice bloke, he's about 8, 9, 10. Very nice bloke, but always, always doing something that goes wrong, but with that sparkle in his eyes that you can't be angry at him. For example, what he does, I don't say that Seb would do that, but his sister wanted a better view of the neighborhood, so Emil bound her to the flagpole and whoosh, up to the top, father, mother screaming. And he says, well, she wanted to have a better view and I gave her one. I mean, and Seb, it's the same thing. For Peter's sake, Seb is not doing things like that. But that sort of personality, he's got that sort of sparkle, as I said, in his eyes. He's a charmer.
You say that, but the other day, BBC TV pit reporter Ted Kravitz was getting changed, and it just happened to be underneath the balcony of Seb's private room in the Red Bull garage, and Seb poured a bottle of cold water all over him, so perhaps he has got a touch of that about him.
You never know. When it's a bit of a private moment, yes, it's very possible. I think he does a lot that we don't hear about. I wouldn't be surprised me at all.
Freddie Petersens, thank you very much for talking to Keeping Track.
Don't forget, you can follow the Australian Grand Prix on Twitter at Oz Grand Prix.
This is Keeping Track, the official podcast of the Australian GP.
Pirelli have been involved in Formula One as far back as the first season of the World Championship in 1950 and returned to the sport after a 20-year absence in 2011 as the sole tyre supplier to all 12 teams. To talk about how the season has gone for the Italian company, we're joined on the phone by Pirelli's Director of Motorsport, Paul Hembree. Paul, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Hey, it's a great pleasure.
Paul, Pirelli's brief for 2011, such as it was, I guess, was to provide tyres that would degrade faster and, you know, therefore spice up the racing a little bit or add an extra variable to proceedings. How has that gone for you? Because that must be a tricky PR exercise to produce tyres that they're being asked to deteriorate to spice up the show. How has that gone?
Well, as you can imagine, at the outset, that was a big change for the sport. It was something that was dramatically different to what had gone on in the previous years. And we had to be ready for all sorts of comment and I'm not going to say criticism, because in the end it came down to a communication exercise for us at the start of the season to explain that was what we were asked to do and is what we tried to deliver. Having said that, maybe as the season has gone on, the teams have got better at using the tyres, they've adapted well to them, and maybe the degradation isn't quite as high as it was at the start of the season. So we'll have some new challenges for next season. But this season, I have to say, we feel that we did bring what we were asked to bring, a little bit of new interest and maybe something that has enhanced the racing.
And Paul, you obviously would have done a lot of simulation work and taken a lot of data into the circuits. Were there any circuits or sets of circumstances or conditions that were particularly challenging this year? We've had quite a few wet races and there's obviously some corners, particularly Turn 8 in Turkey, I guess, is one that everyone talks about, that provide a real challenge for a tyre manufacturer.
Yeah, I mean, oh gosh, we had such a wet European season. There was at one point we thought the rain cloud was following us around Europe. It was ridiculous. You know, everywhere we went, we had a wet race. But I guess from another point of view, that allowed us to get a lot of testing information, because if there was one thing we couldn't really simulate with the teams was actually running in the rain. So that's actually given, bizarrely, a good amount of information for our designers. In regards to circuits, I mean, we've been very fortunate. We've had a lot of support from all of the teams in providing us data that allowed us to simulate, you know, what goes on in a race. I wouldn't say there was any big surprises, apart from maybe saying that the team's development pace is very high, and that's something that's probably not visible from outside of the sport. But when you're actually looking at the data and the times, you can tell that from where they were at the start of the season to where they were at the end of the season, there's a huge amount of development that goes on, and the pace of the cars does increase substantially. So you've also got a moving target. It's not as if you can just rely on, you know, initial season data and think it's going to last, because these guys are the best people in the world at designing these cars, and they're very, very good. So we have to keep a watching brief on the way that developments go on, but I wouldn't say we've had any surprises. I mean, the circuits we knew were going to be difficult were difficult. I think that's the best way of putting it.
Yeah, for sure.
But going forward, you know, it's been a huge learning year for us. We've been able to acquire a lot of real-time data, real race data, and that will obviously make our job a lot easier going forward.
Paul, for the fans here, give us an idea as to the sheer numbers of tyres and, you know, where they're shipped from and the transportation, because I imagine every fortnight, or particularly with the back-to-backs with some of them this year, that must be an incredible undertaking just to get the rubber to the tracks for the cars.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's about 70,000 tyres we use during the season between testing and all the events. And as you say, quite rightly, it's a huge logistical operation. Our factory is based in Izmit, in Turkey, and we have a European logistical base in Didcot, in the UK. So what you have is two different types of racing. You have what we describe as overseas, which is a non-European event, where we ship directly from containers to the location, from the Turkish location, and we then meet up, obviously, with the tyres when we get there. But it's not only tyres, you also have a lot of kits. You need to fit the tyres, and you've got a big operation. So we actually have five sets of what we call logistics kits, and these are the fitting machines. We send those independently, so we don't take, you know, a set to one race and then ship it to the next race. They're actually travelling concurrently. And so we have those kits are always being moved around, and we have to keep an eye on where they are if the shipping's arrived and there's no delays in the customs or there's any shipping delays. For European events, though, it's slightly different, because you will see that we have quite a different paddock set up in the European events. Mm. And we take 12 trucks
to an event. That includes GP2 and GP3 races and our hospitality unit, which is three trucks. And those travel from Didcot, they go to the race, and we set up in probably 2 days it takes us to get everything set up. At the end of the race, then if it's back-to-back, they either go to the next race location or back to Didcot. So from all of that, you can sort of tell that it's quite a big logistical operation. And it needs a lot of planning. We have a dedicated team of logistics planners who are following the tyres, the people, and all the equipment.
Now, Paul, I've got to ask you about a subject here that I know is close to your heart. We've seen an increasing trend towards some teams not running in the third part of qualifying because they feel they might not be able to make the first two or three rows of the grid, and also because of the tyre allocations being the way they are. I know it's a bit of a bugbear of yours, obviously, because it doesn't really help the show, and it doesn't really help you guys showcase the tools that have been provided to the teams. How do we fix this going forward? Is there a fix for it, or is it just the way the rules are going to be and we're just going to have to get used to it?
Well, I mean, as you can imagine, we have had a lot of conversations with the teams regarding this. If you look from their perspective, some of those teams that aren't running would say, well, they've already done more laps than maybe the car that's done pole position anyway during the qualifying process. They would say that it adds to the strategic intrigue of the race because it means they've maybe got one set of new tyres that allows them to have a better position during the race. Bear in mind that the teams that are in that Q2, the end of Q3 area, are very competitive. You know, there's very small gaps between them. So they would say that's why they do it. I think going from the other point of view, and you've quite rightly pointed out what we feel and what we feel, and I think it's going to be the fans that decide. You know, if the fans can understand the technical intrigue or the strategical intrigue, that's fine. But if the fans don't like it, then ultimately as a sport, we have to find a solution. From our point of view, we've offered up some ideas, and we're willing to discuss any ideas that if it does become an issue for the television public or the fans that are in the circuit, then we're open to working with the teams and finding a solution. But as you can imagine, there's so many different ways you can approach it, and there's always pros and cons depending on which way you go. But I think the message is that if it does become a continuing major issue, then we will all find a way of resolving it.
I certainly hope so. Now, Paul, I did want to ask you also about a little anecdote that surfaced in recent times about Sebastian Vettel. It's something that's filtered down the tubes and got down to Australia. I understand that he made a bit of an unscheduled visit to Pirelli's HQ last year, doing a bit of homework for 2011. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it's very true, actually. He was the driver that wanted to come and meet us. I mean, to be honest, he wasn't even talking about tyres. He just wanted to know who we were, who the Pirelli team was, who I was, what was my phone number, meet the bosses. You know, it was he just wanted to understand who we were as a company and what we were trying to achieve in Formula One. And I think that was a nice little anecdote for us to show the detail that the driver such as Sebastian goes into in his search for perfection. And we've obviously seen the results this year. You know, he's had a great car, great year, and he's been a great driver, and has shown the world what a great young champion he is. A lovely guy as well, of course. So it's very pleasing.
You might be getting a few more visitors to HQ at this rate, Paul, I must say. But looking ahead to 2012, what can you tell us in terms of what changes there might be to, you know, perhaps the allocation of tyres or the various compounds, and also the colour coding that you've used this year? I mean, it's worked particularly well at some circuits, but it could always be better, I guess, for the TV and also for the fans in the stands. What have you got planned for 2012 at this stage?
Okay, we're going to be bringing at least three new compounds. It might even be all four will change. We're changing the compounds because we want to close the performance gap between the two choices that we bring to a race. At the moment, you know, it's sometimes 1.2, 1.3 seconds difference, and that's too big. We need to get it down to ideally 0.8 seconds because then that creates a much greater strategic challenge for the teams.
Yeah.
We're also changing the structure and profile of the rear tyre, basically going to give more grip, so to give a bit more performance for the teams to maximise from the tyre. We'll also, with hindsight now and with data and experience, be able to make maybe some slightly more aggressive choices on some circuits. You know, we've found certainly the newer circuits are much smoother than we'd anticipated. Of course, the classic really aggressive ones are as aggressive as we'd imagine. So, you know, there's some circuits we'll always have to be slightly cautious, but there's others now we know we can maybe push it a bit harder and make the racing, we hope, just as exciting. Now, in terms of the colours, we do need to improve. You know, if there's an area we would like to improve is to get a greater colour recognition on the sidewall of the tyre. The colours themselves aren't planning to change at this moment in time, but the marketing department can always come up with a last-minute change, of course. but, yeah, we did make some changes mid-season, which, particularly when we're running in the dusky races, nighttime races, seem to work quite well. Very evident, the colouring on the tyres. But we do recognise for maybe the fans in the stand, we need to do a bit better. So we are working on that and trying to make it a little bit easier for everybody next year. The other point, of course, is we are working with Formula One management because we do supply data to them in live real time during the race. So we actually tell them what tyres are fitted to any particular car, whether they're new, they're used, and what they are. Maybe trying to come up with some on-screen graphics so we can try and explain better to the public during a race what is actually going on. So those are the things that are ongoing, and I'm quite sure that we can make improvements for next season over this year.
Well, that was going to be my personal request, Paul, I must say. Having some sort of graphic on the TV where you've got the running order and the ticker across the bottom, if we just knew for sure what every driver was on at any particular time, I think it would be absolutely perfect and would really add to the TV spectacle and would be a really good thing for the company as well, I would think.
Yeah, sure. As I say, it's technically feasible. We've run the trials this year to look at the data accuracy, and we feel that's something that we should be able to deliver for next season.
Paul, look, thanks very much for joining us on the podcast, and hope you have a good off-season and don't have to spend too much time on planes. I'm sure you've done plenty of that over the last 9 months. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's a great pleasure. Many thanks to everyone.
Tickets to the 2012 Formula One Australian Grand Prix are on sale now. Visit www.grandprix.com.au or call Foxtix on 1800 100 030.
This is Keeping Track, the official podcast of the Australian GP.
Close our final show for 2011. Who better than the man who's already flat out getting ready for the first Grand Prix of the new year? That's Andrew Westacott, of course, the CEO of the Australian Grand Prix Corporation. Andrew, welcome back to Keeping Track.
Thanks, guys. Nice to be back here.
Andrew, you must be pretty excited with Mark Webber's win in Brazil. It's obviously going to be the last race before the Australian Grand Prix. What does that mean for the Australian event?
Well, he did the right thing because we are the next event on the calendar. Season opener next year, 15th to 18th of March in Melbourne, and he's done the right thing by getting his best result for the whole season after sort of probably too many seconds, thirds, fourths and a couple of fifths.
Andrew, by my calculations, there are just over 100 days to go until the Australian Grand Prix. That's a scary thought for me. It must be terrifying for you. Where's the circuit build at and what's involved in all that?
Well, Stuart, the good thing is we've got a fantastic team who do all the scaring, and they've got things well underway. The interesting thing is by virtue of the fact that we're a week earlier than the normal time slot that's been in place for the last 3 years, is all the guys on site will commence around the 15th, 16th of January. We're at the stage of finalising circuit layouts, putting in the necessary requests for road closures and the like, and now it's the detailed planning. We've got all our contracts in place, and people are champing at the bit to start building in Albert Park, and it's looking absolutely fantastic as I speak, given the beautiful rain and weather we've been having down in Melbourne at the moment.
And Andrew, obviously being the first race of the season, it is a very coveted spot. We get to see new drivers in new teams, new liveries. It must be something that you really look forward to hosting that first race of the year.
We do look forward to that, and that's one of the wonderful things. And you know, it's not confirmed that there's going to be two Aussies, but I think Daniel Ricciardo did enough over the weekend to show that he is still performing and deserves a spot in one of the teams. But I know there was no fewer than about five of the other teams who were doing driver changes. A little bit of consideration as to whether Rubens is going to be there. Is Raikkonen going to come back? And I saw overnight that a few of the other teams have appointed first and second drivers, but it is really exciting, and the fact that we're the season opener and there's no footy on that weekend, it's right in the middle of springtime in Melbourne, it's exciting at just 107 days to go.
Yeah, and counting. Andrew, you've mentioned that the event is a week earlier, you've mentioned there's no football, so March 15th to 18th really is the perfect date and gives the event the chance to shine in its own light, doesn't it?
Oh, it does, Stuart. We've done plenty of things over the last few years to improve what people have to on offer at the event. Ticketing this year is the best value for money it's ever been, and if the fans get in and buy their general admission tickets before the 1st of March, they can buy those tickets for $79 only, and kids 12 and under are free. You know, you can get single-day grandstand tickets at $50. Four-day grandstand tickets are only $310. So there's an absolute plethora of things to purchase, and we're doing all we can to improve the viewing, improve the number of amenities, the quality of amenities, and the quality of the entertainment, both on track and off track.
Well, Andrew, look, thanks very much for joining us on this last episode of Keeping Track for 2011, and there's a lot of us here that are really looking forward to that season opening in 2012. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure, guys. I can promise everyone a great time, and they just need to look at the grandprix.com.au website to get all the details and book some tickets. But it's all counting down now, and we look forward to seeing everyone in Albert Park soon.
That brings us to the end of our Keeping Track podcast for 2011. Remember, you can keep in touch with all of the news leading up to next year's season-opening Australian Grand Prix by going to grandprix.com.au, finding us on Facebook, or following us on Twitter. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again in 2012. Bye for now.